Shalom Hadavarniks. Welcome to Hadavar Messianic Ministry School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. We're studying the Jewish life of the Messiah. We're in the 2021 edition. This is Lesson 6, and we're in Session 24. So let's review where we were in Session 23. In Session 23, we witnessed the feeding of the 5,000. Now, the traditional location is Tabcha, but all the biblical data does not point to Tabcha. The biblical data points to an area just south of Bethsaida. Just south of Bethsaida is a plain that's admirably suited for the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. So Yeshua and his disciples left the west side of the Sea of Galilee. We don't know where they were at that time, but they got in a boat and they went over to the east side to the plain where Yeshua fed the 5,000. So here was the plain. Then when the feeding of the 5,000 miracle was completed, Yeshua told his disciples, get in the boat and go to Bethsaida. So they did get into the boat, but they couldn't get to Bethsaida. They tried their best to go north, but a wind came from Mount Hermon. A strong wind came down from Mount Hermon and began to buffet them and push them. And as they fought it and fought it and fought it, they were pushed more out in the middle of the lake. They could not get to Bethsaida. So here, after 9 hours in the storm, this is where we are, stuck in the middle of the lake, rocked by the waves. And then Yeshua comes, walking on the water to them. And they thought he was the angel of death, first of all, but he comforted them. And then we have the famous incident of Peter getting out of the boat and walking on the water for a short distance before he focused on the wind and the waves rather than on the Messiah. So the question we asked in the previous session was, who walks on water? And the answer is, God tramples the waves of the sea. And that's what Yeshua was doing. He was making a claim to deity when he trampled the waves, trampled the water of the Sea of Galilee. So here a little bit of a review. They left there. The plain where the feeding of the 5,000 took place, they tried to get to Bethsaida. They were pushed into the middle of the lake by the heavy wind coming down from Mount Hermon, and they're stuck in the middle of the lake. Then Yeshua comes to them walking on the water, and then we noted that as soon as he got into the boat, bango, they were now at the plain of Gennesaret. They immediately got to the place where they were, got to the west side of the Sea of Galilee. Well, there on the west side of the Sea of Galilee, they ministered. A number of miracles were done. And then Jesus and his disciples walked back to his headquarters in Capernaum. Well, down south is the city of Tiberias on the southwest side of the Sea of Galilee. And we also know that other small boats now left Tiberias and headed out to the plain where the feeding of the 5,000 took place. Well, they couldn't find Jesus there, so some jumped in the boats and looked for him in Capernaum. Others walked around the north side of the Sea of Galilee and found him in Capernaum, where we entered into the Bread of Life discourse. Now, we also talked about simultaneous truths last time. One side of the coin is the sovereignty of God. God is in complete control and is never caught by surprise. The other side of the coin is the free will of man. Humanity makes responsible choices, and both are taught by Scripture, although they seem irreconcilable. But the solution is to remain balanced in the middle and accept the state of tension, accept the paradox. Always fully affirm both truths. That's exactly what the rabbis did. They learned how to handle the Bible early on. They said in Mishnah 03:16, everything is foreseen. That's a reference to God's sovereignty. But the right of choice is granted. That's a reference to man's free will. So the ancient Eastern mind accepted paradox a lot easier than the modern Western mind. And those of us who are modern Westerners need to learn to change our thinking to the thinking of a first century Jewish person. Everything is foreseen, but the right of choice is granted. Affirm them both. Affirm them both. Then we talked about the little prayer boxes called tefillin. Here is a picture of an IDF soldier praying with his tefillin, that's his head tefillin, and his arm tefillin on his upper arm. Now, why did we examine these little prayer boxes? Well, we did so in order to look at the authority of the Mishnah. And in Maaseh Sanhedrin 88b in the Talmud, we read, there is greater stringency in respect to the teachings of the scribes than in respect to the Torah. And that's the point. That's the point. The Pharisees and the scribes, the religious leaders, put more authority, more weight on their traditions than on the written word of God. So they made the written word of God less important than the traditions. One of those examples was korban, and this is the word korban associated carved into a piece of wood. So that was the first example of one of the examples of making the traditions more important than the word of God. And that brings us to the new material. We're in lesson 6, page 42 at the top, and we finished off last session by looking at the response of Jesus to the Pharisees and scribes. Response number one, Yeshua said the true character of the Mishnah is hypocrisy. And then response number two, Pharisaic tradition contradicts the law, causing one to break it or leave it. And the first example of that was the issue of korban. And that's where we pick up the argument today. We pick it up at example number two regarding how the traditions contradict the law or cause one to leave it. So the Sabbath day. This is another example of a Pharisaic tradition. This is not in the Bible. That's because Mishnaic law had a certain statement. Now, in your outline on page 43, you see example number two, the Sabbath day at the top of the page, and below that you see the word Mosaic law. Mosaic law. That should be corrected. That's a mistake of mine. It should be corrected to Mishnaic law. Mishnaic law. We're talking about the Mishnah here, not the law of Moses. So Mishnaic law stated that you can only travel a Sabbath day's journey on the Sabbath. Now that's about a half mile, and there's another correction that you need to make. I believe in your outline you see 1 mile in parentheses. Well, just draw a slash two and make that 1/2 mile, and that'll be corrected. You can only travel a Sabbath day's journey on the Sabbath, and that's about a half mile. Now the Mosaic law, this is explained in the MacArthur Study Bible by Dr. John MacArthur. In the MacArthur Study Bible we read, a Sabbath day's journey, 1/2 of a mile, about 2,000 cubits. The farthest distance a faithful Jew could travel on the Sabbath to accommodate the prohibition of Exodus 16:29. This measurement was derived from tradition based on Israel's encampments in the wilderness. The tents furthest out on the camp's perimeter were 2,000 cubits from the center tabernacle, the longest distance anyone had to walk to reach the tabernacle on the Sabbath day. And those units are also mentioned in Joshua 3:4 and Numbers 35:5. So that's the Mishnaic law. 2,000 cubits, about a half mile. Well, actually, the Mosaic law was a lot stricter than that. In the Mosaic law, you had to stay in your home during the Sabbath. Exodus 16:29. See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you bread for 2 days on the sixth day. Remain every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. Stay in your home and rest on Shabbat. And then Leviticus 23:3. For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Shabbat of complete rest, a holy convocation. You shall not do any work. It is a Sabbath to the Lord in all your dwellings. So remain home, stay in your home and rest. That was the standard of the Mosaic law. But you know, that standard interfered with social or business activities. So the rabbis wanted to figure out a way around it. So they started the tradition by asking the question, well, what is your home? How do you define your dwellings? How do you define your place? And the answer they settled on is where your possessions are. Wherever your possessions are is your home. Now, in those days, everybody owned slaves. It was a worldwide universal phenomena. Slaves were your possessions. So Jewish people owned slaves as well. So if you station your slaves a half mile apart, and by the way, there's a correction there, not 1 mile apart, do a slash two and make that 1/2 mile apart. And then also cross out 10 slaves and make it 20, make it the number 20. So station your slaves a half mile apart. If you had 20 slaves, you could go 10 miles. You could go 10 miles, you'd go from slave to slave, from home to home, from dwelling to dwelling, from possession to possession. You'd never leave your home. I didn't break the Sabbath. I remained in my home. Your home is 10 miles long. Well, this is a legal fiction. And the rabbis understand this to be a legal fiction, and this is very much active as a concept in the Jewish community today. And especially noted in the tractate Erubin, which means blendings. Here's an explanation of Erubin in the Mishnah, in the Talmud. Regulations, Erubin, which makes up, by the way, here, 10 chapters in the Mishnah. 10 chapters, 15 pages in my copy of the Mishnah. Anyway, here's an analysis of Erubin. These are regulations enabling freedom of movement beyond certain prescribed limits on Sabbaths and festivals. A remarkable feature. Now, here's an analysis of Erubin. This is at sacredtext.com. Very good analysis of Erubin. A remarkable feature of the tract Erubin, that's what we're talking about, is the exposition of the manner in which the shrewd sages circumvene the rigorous prohibitions contained in the tract Shabbat, and how they take advantage of every loophole afforded them through imperfections in the law, and at the same time avoiding any palpable infraction of the law itself. So this is an example on how the traditions contradicted the law and caused one to either break it or leave it. Break it or leave it. So now we come to Yeshua's response number 3. He's given us 2 examples of response number 2, and now we're at response number 3. And basically his point here is that the traditions render the law null and void. So we're in the middle of page 43 in your outline. Now please note, to the masses, he's going to speak in parables. But to the disciples, he's going to give explanations. All right, let's take a look then at Mark 7, 14 through 16. After he called the crowd to him again, he began saying to them, "Listen to me, all of you, and understand. There's nothing outside the person which can defile him if it goes into him. But the things which come out of the person are what defile the person. If anyone has ears to hear, let him hear." So here's the parable that he gave to the masses. Now verse 17. "And when he later entered a house away from the crowd, his disciples asked him about the parable." So notice again, the disciples ask, and he's going to explain the parable to them privately, away from the crowd. Now, before expounding the parable, the disciples also state in verse 12 of the book of Matthew 15:12, they also stated, "Then the disciples came and said to him, 'Do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this statement?'" So they're concerned about upsetting the Pharisees here. "Do you know you offended the Pharisees?" That's their concern. You've kind of set them on edge. And what's Yeshua's response to this offense of the Pharisees? Matthew 15, verses 13 and 14. "But he answered and said, 'Every plant which my heavenly Father did not plant will be uprooted. Leave them alone. They are blind guides of blind people. And if a person who is blind guides another who is blind, both will fall into a pit.'" So he has a number of responses regarding Pharisaic Judaism. First of all, in regard to its source, Pharisaism is not planted by God. God is not the source of Pharisaism. It is a weed, not a good plant. But by the way, neither is God the source of any Christian legalistic tradition either that causes you to twist the Bible or leave the Bible or compromise the Bible. So the same advice. don't be overly concerned about offending a legalistic person. God is not the source of Christian legalistic traditions either. All right, now as far as validity goes, he says they are blind guides leading blind followers. So basically, Pharisaism is invalid. It's blindness. They don't know where they're going. And the result, because they don't know where they're going, both will fall into a pit. Both will experience judgment. Both the leader and the follower. Both bear responsibility for following a legalistic tradition like this. We are to follow the word of God, not the traditions of men. So the pit of judgment will be AD 70 and the destruction of the temple and the city of Jerusalem. This is a direct result of the unpardonable sin. Now he's asked to explain the parable. And the parable is explained at the bottom of page 43. We pick it up in Matthew 15:15. Peter said to him, "Explain the parable to us." So Peter is the spokesman, and this is significant. He's taking a leadership role. He's eager to learn the truth. So let's continue in verses 16 through 20. Jesus said, "Are you also still lacking in understanding? Do you not understand that everything that goes into the mouth passes into the stomach and is eliminated? But the things that come out of the mouth come from the heart, and those things defile the person. For out of the heart comes evil thoughts, murders, acts of adultery, other immoral sexual acts, thefts, false testimonies, slanderous statements. These are the things that defile the person, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile the person." So the issue here is, where does defilement originate? Now the Pharisees emphasized the external. They had an external emphasis, the act itself. But the Mosaic Law emphasizes the thought, not the act. The Mosaic Law goes one step earlier and emphasizes the thought. So the Mosaic Law has an internal emphasis. So, for example, the Mosaic Law said, "Don't eat pork." However, the moment you decide to eat that ham sandwich, the internal decision you made is the origin of sin. Actions are simply the carrying out of your internal decisions. If internal righteousness is there in the person first, then external righteousness will naturally flow out of their behavior. All right, so let's move to Mark chapter 7, verse 19. And we read in verse 19, "Because it does not go into his heart, but into his stomach, and is eliminated," and then Mark adds a nice little explanatory note here, "thereby he declared all foods clean." Now, "all foods are clean" is true of the next dispensation of grace. And remember, Mark is writing the book of Mark during the dispensation of grace. It was written after the church got underway. So he's writing this during the dispensation of grace, and the fact that all foods are clean is true of the dispensation of grace. It was not true of the dispensation of law when Yeshua was actually living this out. But now he has been crucified, buried, and raised, and the church has started, and now we live under the dispensation of grace, in which all foods are clean. Now, it's significant that Peter is the spokesman, but he doesn't learn the lesson here. He has to be retaught the lesson in Acts 10, again, after the church is functioning again. In Acts 10, he learns that lesson again. Now, the incident is the sheet of foods and Cornelius in Acts 10. So let's take a look at this incident. "On the next day, as they," this is the Gentile delegation from Cornelius, "were on their way and approaching the city," this is Joppa, "Peter went up on the housetop about the sixth hour to pray." Now, he was in the house of Simon the Tanner, and you can visit the house of Simon the Tanner today as well. This is the door to the house. It's owned by the Zakarian family today. Now, this picture shows our guide, Hela, explaining all about Acts chapter 10. And you notice the blue barrier in front of the house is a door. Well, they need that because if there wasn't a nice barrier there, this house would be inundated with tourists. But, you know, fortunately, Gila knew Mrs. Zakarian very well, and she allowed us in to see the interior of the house and to see the spot probably where Peter was preparing to eat his lunch up on the rooftop. Let's continue on now. But he became hungry and he was desiring to eat. But while they were making preparations, he fell into a trance and he saw the sky opened up and an object like a great sheet coming down lowered by four corners to the ground. And there were in it all kinds of four-footed animals and crawling creatures of the earth and birds of the air. In other words, they're all unclean animals, unclean under the strictures of the Mosaic Law. And remember now, Peter is not living under the Mosaic Law at this time. He's now living under the Law of Messiah. The church has been formed. The birthday of the church has passed. And he's living during the church age, during the dispensation of grace. He's living under the law of the Messiah. And a voice came to him, "Get up, Peter, kill and eat." But Peter said, "By no means, Lord, for I have never eaten anything unholy and unclean." Again a voice came to him a second time, "What God has cleansed, no longer consider unholy." This happened three times, and immediately the object was taken up into the sky. And while Peter was greatly perplexed in mind as to what the vision which he had seen might be, behold, the men who had been sent by Cornelius, having asked directions for Simon's house, appeared at the gate. And calling out, they were asking whether Simon, who was also called Peter, was staying there. While Peter was reflecting on the vision, the Spirit said to him, "Behold, three men are looking for you. Get up, go downstairs, and accompany them without misgivings, for I have sent them myself." So Peter's up there meditating on what he's just seen. What does all this mean? Well, he's going to get his answer in just a moment. Now we're at verse 24 of Acts 10. On the following day, he, which is Peter, entered Caesarea. Now Cornelius was waiting for them and had called together his relatives and close friends. When Peter entered, Cornelius met him and fell at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter raised him up, saying, "Stand up, stand up. I too am just a man." And as he talked with him, he entered and found many people assembled. And he said to them, "You yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or to visit him. And yet, here's the lesson, God has shown me that I should not call any man unholy or unclean." He finally understands the lesson that the Lord has been trying to teach him. Now, this is a Kal v'chomer argument from the lesser to the greater. If all animals are clean for food, that's the lesser, how much more, here's the greater, how much more are all people clean and objects for salvation? In other words, Gentiles can be saved by faith in Yeshua. Gentiles are savable. Now, remember, we also want to remember Yeshua's opinion regarding the necessity of washing hands. Matthew 15:20. "These are the things that defile the person, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile the person." So to get back to this issue, he did not regard this tradition as obligatory because the Bible does not require hand washing for every meal. This is a rabbinic tradition, and the rabbis admit this fact in the Talmud, Berachot 52b. You read there, "There is no scriptural requirement to wash the hands before eating unconsecrated food, before eating your everyday meal." So Yeshua talked about the true source of defilement, inner uncleanness, not outer uncleanness. Now, this section marks one of the major conflicts Yeshua has with the Pharisaic party. This is a major conflict because of the importance the Pharisees placed on the tradition of hand washing. From their point of view, to neglect hand washing was to be guilty of gross carnal defilement. and they had a lot to say about it, and they developed a very whole bunch of complex rituals about it. And that summary is on page 46 of your outline to summarize some of the rituals. So they said in the traditional writings a good number of things about hand washing. First of all, its omission would lead to temporal destruction. You'd be judged if you didn't wash your hands. Another example, this is in Sotta 4b. Whoever eats bread without first washing his hands, it is as though he had sinned with a harlot, as though he had participated in prostitution. Shabbat 62b. Rabbi Abahu said, others say, in a Baraita, it was taught, three things bring man to poverty. And what's one of them? Treating the washing of hands with disrespect. You can get poor because of that. Its omission would lead to poverty. They said that bread eaten with unwashed hands is as if the bread was filth. In fact, a rabbi who held the command to wash the hands in contempt was actually buried and outcast from the community. He was excommunicated from the community. And we read that in the Talmud Sotta 4b. A person who despises the washing of hands before a meal is to be excommunicated, kicked out of the community. And in fact, that has happened. Finally, they felt that anything that comes from unwashed hands was dangerous, and that a whole legion of demons stood ready to take advantage of such an oversight. And this is Maaseh Berachot 51a. Rabbi Ishmael ben Elisha said, three things were told me by Suriel, the officer of the divine presence. Do not let water be poured over your hands by one who has not already washed his own hands. Because, here's the reason why, you got to be super careful. Because a company of demons, and according to others, a band of destroying angels, lie in wait for a man and say, when will the man do one of these things so that we can catch him? So watch out. If you don't wash your hands, the demons are going to get you. Now, here. They have already accused Yeshua of being demon-possessed. So note the convergence. Demon possession and unwashed hands are linked together. So as Yeshua, as his disciples, eat their food with unwashed hands, they say, look at that! Their behavior is demonic. Yeshua's behavior is demonic. We told you he was possessed by a demon. He can't be the Messiah. Well, we'll see this charge come up again. Remember, it's a major issue between Yeshua and the Pharisees. It'll be one of the issues that lead to his crucifixion. So there's an article detailing this in greater length, page 46. You can read that at your leisure. Download your notes and read that article on page 46. Now we're on lesson 6, page 47. We're at the top of the page. And we've come to section 112, Ministry to a Believing Gentile Woman in Tyre and Sidon. Matthew 15, Mark 7. So he goes north now to Gentile territory. He withdraws again from Galilee. Verse 24 of Mark 7. Now Yeshua got up and went from there to the region of Tyre. And when he had entered a house, he wanted no one to know about it. And yet he could not escape notice. Now here's a map of the area. Now we don't know exactly where he was ministering at this time, perhaps in the Gospel Triangle down there. But wherever he was, he leaves the area of Galilee and he goes up north to the Gentile city of Tyre. The Gentile city of Tyre. Now he's staying quiet. He's staying out of the way because his emphasis is on training the 12. So now we pick it up in Matthew 15:22 with an incident that interrupts his teaching program, his classes. Matthew 15:22. And a Canaanite woman from that region came out and began to cry out saying, have mercy on me, Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed. So this is a Gentile woman. And she has this conversation with Yeshua. Now, the basis of her request for healing is his messianic character, son of David. His messianic character has been rejected by Israel. So his answer is going to be no. He doesn't do anything for anybody on the basis of his messianic character. Verse 23. But he did not answer her even a word. So there's his answer, no. And his disciples came up and urged him, saying, send her away because she keeps shouting at us. Now, he will not perform miracles based on his messianic character because that's been rejected by Israel. But she understands that, but she continues. She's extremely persistent, and he allows her persistence, much to the chagrin of his disciples. You know, send her away. She keeps shouting at us. She's bothering us. Verse 24. But he answered and said, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So the answer is, again, no. The Messiah was sent to Israel. I will not perform miracles on that basis because Israel has rejected my messiahship. Verse 25. But she came and began to bow down before him, saying, Lord, help me. Now he will perform miracles on the basis of faith in response to personal need. And now she comes to him with her personal need. Lord, help me. Now just to make sure she understands what's going on here, verse 26. Yet he answered and said, it's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs, to the puppies. Now, the children are Israel, dogs. Dogs are a term in Jewish literature for Gentiles. But Yeshua is not being racist here. Here he uses the diminutive puppy, pet. This is not nearly as harsh a statement as the usual English translation makes it seem. You know, it's not good to throw it to the puppies, to the pets. Now, this statement is a reminder that on the basis of his messianic character, he will not help her. The Messiah was sent to Israel. He will not give the Gentiles what was intended for Israel. But then she responds in verse 27. And she said, yes, Lord. You know, I get it, Lord. Yes, Lord. But please help, for even the puppies feed on the crumbs that fall from their master's table. So her faith shines forth here. To paraphrase her response, I'm not asking for you to take what belongs to the Jews and give it to the Gentiles. I'm not asking you to take what belongs to the Jewish person and give it to me. I'm just simply asking for the overflow from Israel. Let me receive the crumbs that fall from the table. Matthew 28:15-28. Then Yeshua said to her, O woman, your faith is great. It shall be done to you as you desire. And her daughter was healed at once. So the answer is yes, in response to personal need on the basis of faith. Now we're at lesson 6, page 48, at the top of the page, section 113, healing in Decapolis, Matthew 15, Mark 7. So the location is Gentile territory. Here's the Decapolis. The Greek word Decapolis means 10 cities. It was 10 united cities of basically Gentile population. Some Jews were living in those cities. So he's up here in Tyre, and so they make the trip down to probably the northern corner there of the Decapolis, right up against the Sea of Galilee. And we pick it up on Mark 7:31-32. Again, he left the region of Tyre and came through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee, within the region of Decapolis. And they brought to him one who was deaf and had difficulty speaking, and they begged him to lay his hands on him. So someone comes. This is a Jew, probably. He brings a friend who needs healing. Now, saliva, spittle, was considered medicinal in the Jewish community. Verses 33 and 34. And Jesus took him aside from the crowd by himself and put his fingers in his ears. And after spitting, he touched his tongue with the saliva. And looking up to heaven with a deep sigh, he said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. So Yeshua takes him aside privately. The miracles are for individuals. They're not for the Jewish masses. Now, his sign language there. He's either asking him through sign language, do you want to hear? Or he's using sign language to inform the deaf man about what he's going to do. So we don't know exactly what he was saying to the deaf man, one of those two messages. In summary, he's saying, I'm going to heal you. One way or another, he's saying, I'm going to heal you, using first century sign language. So verses 35 and 36. And his ears were opened, and the impediment of his tongue was removed, and he began speaking plainly, and he gave them orders not to tell anyone. But the more he ordered them, the more widely they continued to proclaim it. So the man is healed, but the instructions are still the same. He's to tell no man. This is probably because he's Jewish. It's probably because he's a Jewish person. And the principle of privacy and of secrecy pertains only to the Jews. So this person needs to obey that instruction. He does not, but that's the instruction he was given. Now, the last time Yeshua was here, he healed the Gentile demoniac named Legion. And then he sent this Gentile man out to tell others. This is the result of the man's testimony in the Decapolis. The Gentiles now come to hear Yeshua. Matthew 15, 31 and 30 and 31. And large crowds came to him, bringing with them those who were limping, had impaired limbs, were blind, or were unable to speak, and many others, as they laid them down at his feet, and he healed them. So the crowd was astonished as they saw those who were unable to speak, talking, those with impaired limbs restored, those who were limping, walking around, and those who were blind, seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. So Jesus goes ahead and he heals many others. Gentiles. He heals many, many Gentiles. And the Gentiles are now glorifying the God of Israel. But Yeshua's principle regarding mass healings and secrecy does not apply to the Gentiles. And so here he heals Gentile crowds. And so the Gentiles, the lesson is that Gentiles will also benefit from the ministry of the Messiah. But the policy of individual healing and secrecy still applies to the Jewish people. Now we're at lesson 6, page 48, in the middle of the page. We're in section 114, feeding the 4,000 in Decapolis, Matthew 15, Mark 8, 1 through 9. So the location again is the Decapolis, and so we're probably located right up here in that northern quadrant of the Decapolis, that northern corner right up against the Sea of Galilee. And the incident. We begin with Matthew 15:38. And those who ate were 4,000 men besides women and children. So this is a miraculous feeding, but only 4,000 men are counted. The total, including the women and children, probably was more like 10 to 16,000 people. And now the miracle itself is discussed in Mark 8, 1 through 9. In those days, when there was again a large crowd and they had nothing to eat, Yeshua summoned his disciples and said to them, I feel compassion for the people because they've remained with me for 3 days and already, and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way. And some of them have come from along a great distance. And his disciples replied to him, where will anyone be able to find enough bread here in this desolate place to satisfy these people? And he was asking them, how many loaves do you have? And they said, 7. And he directed the people to recline on the ground, and taking the 7 loaves, he gave thanks and broke them and started giving them to his disciples to serve. And they served them to the people. Also, they also had a few small fish. And after he had blessed them, he told the disciples to serve these as well. And they ate, and they were satisfied. And they picked up 7 large baskets full of what was left over of the broken pieces. About 4,000 men were there. And he dismissed them. So we have this conversation with the disciples to teach them the lesson. The lesson, depend on me. Distribute what I provide. It's the same lesson he taught previously to the feeding of the 5,000. And so the additional lesson, just as we saw in the last section, Gentiles will benefit from the Messiah's coming. Now, there were two miraculous feedings, as this chart will point out. In regard to the number involved, the first one involved 5,000 men plus women and children, and the second involved 4,000 men plus women and children. The location, one was near Bethsaida, the other was in the Decapolis. As far as the time, the feeding of the 5,000 only took one day, only encompassed one day. The feeding of the 4,000 encompassed 3 days. As far as leftovers, the feeding of the 5,000 had 12 baskets of leftovers, the feeding of the 4,000, 7 baskets of leftovers. And finally, Yeshua's comment in Matthew 16:9 and 16:10 refers to 2 separate miraculous feedings. Now, this may seem obvious to you, but why do I emphasize it? That's because critics of the New Testament often state that these 2 events are the same event and that the writers are all confused and contradictory. They don't know what they're talking about. It looks like 2, but there was really only 1. That's what critics will say. And they'll say the Bible is unreliable because of this. But as you can see, there are 2 very clearly 2 separate events. There's no contradiction. There's no confusion on the part of the gospel. So don't let people throw that kind of a silly argument at you. All right, lesson 6, page 49 at the top of the page, section 115, return to Galilee and an encounter with the Pharisees and Sadducees. So we begin with the rejection at Magadan in Matthew 15:39. And sending away the crowds, Yeshua got into the boat and came to the region of Magadan. Now this is Jewish territory. Now they got in the boat somewhere to the south here, the south part of the Sea of Galilee, perhaps at Gadara, perhaps at Susisa, we don't know, but they were right up against the Sea of Galilee in that little corner of the Decapolis. So they get in a boat, and we do know where they ended up. They cross the lake, and they end at the city, the region of Magdala, or I should say, Magadan. Now, Mark calls this area Dalmanutha. Well, there's no contradiction here because this town and this area had 4 synonymous terms to identify this place, 4 names for this city. The first one was Magdala, Mary of Magdala. She came from there. Then Magadan. Then Dalmanutha, which Mark uses, and Tarike as well. So this can be known by 4 different names. All right, let's pick it up in Matthew 16:1. The Pharisees and Sadducees came up, and putting Jesus to the test, they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. So as soon as he's back in Jewish territory, they pounce. The Pharisees are there right away. They want another sign from heaven. They want to question him some more. However, the conclusion that they always reach is that the sign is not from heaven, the sign is from hell. So Jesus will not give them any more signs but 1. He's only going to provide 1 more sign at his time and place. His response then is in verses 2 and 3. He replied to them, "When it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, there will be a storm today, for the sky is red and threatening. You know how to discern the appearance of the sky, but you are unable to discern the signs of the times." So the point of this statement is that sufficient signs and evidence have already been given. This is not a weather report. This is a parable to unbelieving religious leaders. Verse 4. "An evil and adulterous generation wants a sign, and so a sign will not be given it except the sign of Jonah." And he left them and went away. Again, "For the nation there will be no signs but 1, the sign of the prophet Jonah, the sign of resurrection." Now, let's remember back to John chapter 2, verses 18 through 22. Remember back at the beginning of the ministry? The Jews then said to him, "What sign do you show us as your authority for doing these things?" And Yeshua answered them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And the Jews then said, it took 46 years to build this temple, and yet you will raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking about the temple of his body. So when he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Yeshua had spoken. So his resurrection will be the sign to Israel that they're asking for. You know, we want a sign. He gives it to him. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. He's anticipating all that's coming in the future. Okay, this is a good spot to share some thoughts of application. We're in lesson 6, page 50 at the top of the page. Now, the theme I chose was Messiah's Lordship. And the biblical material looked like this. Yeshua kept driving home the point that to call him Lord means that we must live our lives his way, not our way. First example, the disciples thought that feeding the 5,000 and feeding the 4,000 was impossible. Until they did it his way, they submitted and they were blessed. Secondly, the Galilean masses learned that he would not be king on their terms. They tried to force him to be king. They had to accept him his way. They rejected that principle, and they lost out. Thirdly, the Pharisees again got the message that he would not live his life their way in submission to the Mishnah. Jesus demanded that they live their life his way. They rejected him and lost out. The Syrophoenician woman learned that he was Lord. She submitted and was blessed. Her daughter was healed. So let's apply this to our own lives personally. Are you struggling? Am I struggling? Are we struggling against the Messiah's lordship in our life? Or are we submitting and being blessed? That's the question we got to ask ourselves. So write down that area of struggle or that area of submission you're experiencing today if you're identifying with this application. It's something you could be experiencing today in the area of your body or your soul or your spirit, the three areas where we get tempted. All right, then move on. Move on from the personal application to a plan of action. Write down something. Write down how you could practically respond in this area of struggle. How can I submit to Yeshua's lordship? All right, well, that brings us to the end of of lesson 6, and we now have come to lesson 7, page 1 on your outline, lesson 7. And page 1 of lesson 7 is the table of contents, labeling section 116 down to section 130. And then page 2, labeling section 131 down to section 134. So those are the first two pages of lesson 7 for you. So let's move on to section 100 and section 116. Now, at the conclusion of section 115, Jesus leaves the fishing village of Magadan, and this is Mark 8:13. And leaving them, he again embarked and went away to the other side. Now, here's the area of Magadan. Now, the scripture doesn't tell us where he went, just that he went to the east side of the Sea of Galilee. So they made landfall somewhere on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, which was basically Gentile territory. So they're in Gentile territory again. And now we come to section 116, warning about the error of the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Herodians. It's a warning against three types of leaven. Now, leaven is a biblical symbol of sin that Yeshua utilizes and that the New Testament utilizes. And here are some quotes that you'll find at the bottom of page 3. Bottom of page 3, you'll find these quotes. From the Talmud, Ma'aseh Berachot 17a. Rav Alexandri, on concluding his prayer, used to add the following, Sovereign of the universe, it is known full well to thee that our will is to perform thy will. And what prevents us? And the answer comes, the yeast in the dough. Footnote 3. explains, footnote 3 explains, that is the evil impulse. The yeast in the dough is the evil impulse which causes ferment in the heart. Now this is picked up in Galatians 5, 7 through 9. Now Shaul was a rabbi. He was very familiar with this symbol. He says to the Galatians, "You were running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth?" There's the sin. "This persuasion did not come from him who calls you. A little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough." Disobedience infects your whole life. And then 1 Corinthians 5, 6 through 8. "Your boasting is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough? Clean out the old leaven. Clean out the old sin, so that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. Why are you unleavened? For Messiah, our Passover, also has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us celebrate the feast, not with the old leaven of disobedience, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth." Sincerity and truth. All right. Let's move on then to Matthew 16, verses 5 and 6. He's warned them about the Pharisees and the Sadducees, two kinds of leaven. The false teaching of the Pharisees and, number two, the false teaching of the Sadducees. "The disciples came to the other side of the sea, and they had forgotten to bring any bread. And Jesus said to them, 'Watch out and beware the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees.'" Two types of leaven then. So now we move on to Mark 8:15, and he was giving orders to them saying, "Watch out, beware the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." So here's a third kind of leaven. Leaven of the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Herod. Now what's the definition of these three kinds of leaven? For the religious party, the false teaching is the fact that they teach that Yeshua is not the Messiah on the grounds of being demon-possessed. That's false teaching. He's not demon-possessed. Secondly, the priestly party, their false teaching. Yeshua is not the Messiah because he's against the temple. Now, they're picking up on John 2:19. And at the end of his ministry, they will falsely accuse him of saying, "He said he would destroy the temple." Well, this is what Yeshua actually said in John 2:19. Yeshua answered them, "You all destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Greek word "destroy" is in the second person plural. He didn't say, "I'll destroy this temple." He said, "You all will destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." So they have false teaching there. They're twisting his words to make it seem like he's guilty. So that's the Sadducees' false teaching. He's against the temple. And then we have the political party's teaching, the Herodians. Yeshua is not the Messiah because he's an insurrectionist. He calls himself the King of the Jews, but he's against the rule of Rome. He's against the rule of Rome through the house of Herod. He says he's the King of the Jews. He's an insurrectionist. He's starting a rebellion. Matthew 16, 7. "They began to discuss this among themselves," talking about the bread now. "They began to discuss this among themselves, saying, 'He said that because we didn't bring any bread.'" So in verse 7, the disciples misunderstand. They think bread. They're thinking of literal food. And Yeshua reprimands them in Matthew 16, 8 through 11. But Yeshua, aware of this, said, "You men of little faith, why are you discussing among yourselves the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet understand nor remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000, how many baskets you picked up? Nor the 7 loaves of the 4,000, and how many large baskets you picked up? How is it that you do not understand that I did not speak to you about bread? But beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." So two lessons here. One, beware of false teaching, especially false teaching about his person and his work. But they also have not learned the lesson of the miraculous feeding. So lesson number two, Yeshua can provide in any situation. But they're overly concerned about the physical rather than the spiritual. Verse 12. Then they understood that he did not say, beware of the leaven of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees. So the point, beware of false teaching regarding the person and work of Yeshua. They finally get it. They finally understand. All right, we're now at section 117. We're at page 4 at the top of the page. I've got about 5 minutes, so I'm going to push on through section 117. The healing of a blind man at Bethsaida, Mark 8, verses 23 through 26. So the location is in verse 22. And they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a man who was blind to Yeshua and begged him to touch him. So he leaves his, they leave their location on the east side, and they, east side of the Sea of Galilee, and they go up to Bethsaida. Now we don't know where they were located, but we do know where they ended up. They ended up in Bethsaida, which is Jewish territory on the very eastern side, the very eastern edge of the Galilee and the very eastern edge of the region of Galilee and the Sea of Galilee. And then a miracle occurs in verses 23 through 25. Taking the man who was blind by the hand, he brought him out of the village. And after spitting in his eyes and laying his hands on him, he asked him, do you see anything? And he looked up and said, I see people, for I see them like trees walking around. Then again he laid his hands on his eyes, and he looked intently, and he was restored, and he began to see everything clearly. So he takes this blind man, and he spits in his eyes, and remember, saliva was considered medicinal. This is not gross from the Jewish perspective of the first century. For example, in Bathra 126b, because when people came to his father, he used to say to them, go to my son Sikath, who was firstborn, and his spittle heals. There is a tradition that the spittle of the firstborn of a father is healing. So there's an example of it in Baba Batra. And then in Shabbat 14:4, they say to the man, they say in the name of Rav Yochanan, and I, which became inflamed, do they treat on the Sabbath? And Rav said, wine may be placed outside the eyes on the Sabbath, but may not be placed inside of the eyes. And Samuel said this, it's prohibited to put tasteless spit into the eyes on the Sabbath. So the wine and the spit are both considered medicinal, but you don't heal any eyes on the Sabbath. All right, please note, he's been taken out of the village. So the policy of privacy for the masses continues. This miracle is not for Jewish masses. And this is the only miracle that occurs in two stages. It's a unique miracle. He starts with partial sight. He ends up with total sight. Now, why? Why the stages? Well, the miracle depicts, number one, the disciples' spiritual condition, and number two, Israel's spiritual condition. Let's take a look at verse 26. And he sent him to his home, saying, do not even enter the village. Again, the policy is privacy. And it applies to the disciples in this way. Now they see partially, they are partially sighted. The next paragraph will show that, paragraph 118. But the fact that they are also partially blind comes out of paragraph 119. And this total blindness, this removal of total blindness will come at Pentecost, when the Holy Spirit is poured out. So that is the application to the disciples. Now, the application to Israel. Now, as a result of the rejection of the Messiah, Romans 11 says that a partial blindness has been fallen Israel. Romans 11, 25. For I do not want you, brethren, to be uninformed of this mystery, so that you will not be wise in your own estimation, that a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. So today, Israel is partially blind, partially hard. Therefore, some Jews are coming to saving knowledge of Yeshua today. That's us. That's us. That's those of us who are Messianic Jews, the faithful remnant. And so Israel is partially sighted through the remnant, through Jewish believers. But Israel is also partially blind. In fact, mostly blind. and Israel's blindness will be removed at the end of the tribulation, as Romans 11:26 says, and so all Israel will be saved, just as it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion, he will remove ungodliness from Jacob. So at the end of the tribulation, all Israel will be saved, all Israel will be fully sighted. All right, I've run out of time. So we'll pick it up next session with section 118. We'll find ourselves in Caesarea Philippi. We'll find ourselves up north in Gentile territory for a very, very detailed and important section where Peter identifies Yeshua as the Messiah. All right, so join us. Join us next session for session 118. And Peter's identification as Yeshua, the Messiah, as Yeshua is the Messiah. It's a great section. It'll take us quite a bit of time to get through it. I know you'll enjoy it. Okay, till then, Lehith Road. We'll see you later.